you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, yeah.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have Florian Geyer back on the show. Of course, Florian Geyer is the host of Mysterium Fasces. Florian, how are you doing?
I'm doing just grand, Tim. It's a pleasure and an honor to be back on Our Interesting Times, one of my very favorite podcast sort of interview platforms.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, I listened to your podcast, and recently you've done a few monologues. And this one that you did was on the new colonialism, something that's happening in Canada, particularly out west, I guess in the Pacific Northwest area, the Fraser Valley, I think. I'm not too familiar with Canada, that sort of thing. But
mm-hmm.
And this just has something to do with, I guess, Chinese
yes,
immigrants
certainly.
Coming in. And this is, you know, Canada itself has experienced something similar to the United States with the sort of demographic changes and some say replacement. And this is coupled with low birth rates.
Mm-hmm.
Families aren't forming anymore, and so I guess sort of the in your talk you talk about this is there's economic, there's also a moral component here, how sort of the demoralization of the West is also facilitating this. So I'll let you take it from there.
Right. So I mean, I think the crux of my little talk is I was reflecting on my experiences living and visiting in the lower mainland of British Columbia, the Fraser River Valley area. So that's just Greater Vancouver, basically, for those who are not familiar with the idiosyncrasies of Canadian geography. Canada, since Trudeau Sr. changed the immigration laws, has experienced, as many other countries in the West have, an unprecedented level of foreign migration and non-European migration. And so Canada, as it stands, is about one-third foreign-born as of the time of recording of this podcast. In terms of official statistic, well, one-third foreign-born or descendant of non-European immigrants. Now, this is in stark contrast to the previous immigration policy that was established in Canada, which favored the traditional European settlers of North America, which specifically people from the British Isles and then from Western Europe to a lesser degree. And so after the kind of much like the Immigration Act of 1965 in the United States, after Trudeau came in, senior, and kind of chopped everything up and liberalized the immigration system. There kind of has been in ever increasing numbers mass immigration from various parts of various non-Western countries, essentially. So this situation is kind of ties back into the whole issue of demographic replacement and white genocide and the destruction of organic government and ethnicity. And so in the West, you have a situation where, like, the city of Richmond, which is a suburb of Vancouver directly to its south, is approximately 70 to 85% East Asian, with a plurality, something like 45 to 55% Han Chinese. And then the rest is made up from people from the Indian subcontinent and other flavors of High Orientals. And so this is the kind of the reality of the situation. Kind of to case in point, I went into a hot pot establishment the other day, and you know, you can sort of order calf aorta, you know, and pig's feet and this kind of business. kind of a smelly and poignant marker on the changing ethnic trends. There was no less than five major league gaming cafes on that same street as the hot pot establishment. So this sort of situation, kind of a little bit of the history of what was going on in the West, is the Chinese immigration kind of goes back actually a very, very long time, I mean, into prehistory. One of the things that I talk about on Mysterium Fasces is we kind of get into like Whig historiography.
Mm-hmm.
Whiggish history, and that like Western establishment history and anthropology is oftentimes completely fabricated or produced out of a sense of just sort of grand hubris. And so in Western Canada, many of the Aboriginal groups there will attest to contact with Chinese merchants well into the 14th and 13th centuries. You know, there are actually archaeological finds of Chinese coins from pre-Qing era dynasties and so forth. So the Chinese have been in that part of the world for a long time. However, the Chinese traditionally have been a very sort of insular people. Zhongguo, China, the Middle Kingdom, is considered to be the center of the world, literally the axis of heaven and earth, and everyone outside of Zhongguo is uncivilized, decadent barbarians. And so this mentality has kind of meant that Chinese international trade was largely confined to its immediate sphere of influence. Now, as certainly all of our listeners will be aware, in the 20th and 21st century, this has changed radically. So in the context of the sort of greater Vancouver, or the Fraser River Valley region, lower mainland, I'll just say greater Vancouver for brevity, what happened was the first big influx of Chinese immigration, but specifically moneyed Chinese immigration, happened after Hong Kong was repatriated to China in the 90s. And a whole bunch of Chinese merchants and other sort of wealthy types fled Hong Kong with a lot of, shall we say, unscrupulous funds. I'm familiar with myself and members of my family, we worked with quite a few Chinese businessmen and fellows in that area, and there's a term that they call it pirate money. And so, you know, sort of fellows would show up from Hong Kong in the 90s with sort of chests full of doubloons, and they would be trying to buy property for big sapphires, this kind of stuff. It still persists to a certain degree today. And so and this is actually kind of a humorous anecdote, and if you ask the various Chinese communities in Richmond, they will confirm this for you. After Hong Kong was flipped to the Chinese sovereignty, you know, they were looking for kind of a place to emigrate to, and some of them went to Australia, some of them went to London, but many of them came to Vancouver. And they were, when they were deciding where they wanted to settle, the shallow and decadent Hong Kong elite stumbled upon the city of Richmond, and they kind of sort of mistranslated this into Chinese, understanding it to be rich man.
They didn't go to Puerto Rico.
I know, shocking. I know, shocking. Yeah, no, they didn't go to Haiti either. I don't know. Can't fathom why. So what happened is this was sort of kind of the spearhead where you had a lot of influx of Chinese capital. And in China, the mentality has always been to invest in land. Land in property is considered to be the gold standard for stable investment. And that is still the case to this day. And being a property owner in China is really what sets you apart from being a peasant, kind of by definition, especially in an urban context. And China's kind of ethno-social hierarchy is very stratified, where you've got about 20-15% of the country is civilized and educated and has been running everything for the last 4,000 or 5,000 years since they've had organized government and bureaucracy. And anybody who has contact with Chinese immigrant communities, serious and legitimate contact, will recognize this quite immediately, that there are very distinct types and strata of Han Chinese. And so there are the civilized types, and there are the uncivilized types, and they're radically different, radically different. And it's just basically the distinction between burr and peasant. And so in the in Greater Vancouver, what happened is that they came in the 90s and they began to invest heavily in property. Now, Canada, in its grand laissez-faire international capitalist style, doesn't really have strong capital, foreign capital controls, or strong controls over foreign capital purchasing property. And so what happened is, through the usual sort of seeping corruption, more and more Chinese and more Chinese capital began to flood into Vancouver. And in the last sort of 20 years especially, this has resulted in massive inflation, to the point where Vancouver is in the right downtown Vancouver, it is more expensive than Tokyo. Hmm. It's some of the most expensive real estate in the entire world. You know, if you live in downtown Vancouver, if you have a one room bachelor apartment and you condo that out, you can expect, depending on the location, anywhere from $500,000 to $750,000 Canadian. So that's the level of price inflation. Regular kind of split level homes go from anywhere from $1 million to $2 million, depending on the area. So this situation is obviously extremely unstable. I mean, it causes a whole host of social grievances, mostly that the indigenous working class and non-moneyed classes cannot afford property, and people become beholden to landlords who are also predominantly at this time Chinese. And so I guess this kind of comes full circle, is that in my show I just kind of explicated that you have the one of the greatest tactics, sort of Alinskyite liberal debating tactics, progressive debating tactics, is no engagement or no platforming, or if that doesn't work, a moral response rather than a factual response. And so with white genocide, they either deny that it's happening and call people, Nazis or racists if they bring this up, hoping that this will work on sheer moral intimidation alone. Although recently some of them have been starting to admit it, and they say, actually, that's a good thing because white people are evil and deserve to be genocided. There's been some interesting stories that have gone around to kind of arguing to this effect. And so the point was merely to say that, it's not a matter – it's not an issue of opinion. There's no way that you can get into a factual debate on the nature of demographic replacement in these areas without conceding the obvious point that it is kind of New Vancouver. It is a Chinese colony, and I personally believe that by the end of the century, it will probably be an official exclave of China, as Hong Kong, as Hong Kong is.
Hmm. So, this was a product of the diaspora that occurred when Hong Kong returned to China in 1997, and you mentioned as pirate money. So a lot of this is a product of, the international narcotics trafficking and arms trading, a lot of the money being deposited in banks in Hong Kong and these things, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that and, property development, which is, in Hong Kong is also an extension of organized crime, and the rest of China is quite tied into that. I mean, Chinese oligarchy in general is very diversified. And so there's not a lot of, as in the United States and the rest of the world and Russia and so forth, there's not a lot of division between these various branches of organized criminals. just different levels of a sort of by fiat legitimacy and state involvement.
Mm-hmm.
So,
And this is, of course, coinciding with this, I guess there's a couple of decades of cultural change within Canada, like in the United States, where you had, I guess you could say the cultural Marxists were ascendant, and you had a certain attitudes and values being promoted at the expense of traditional values, things like birth control, smaller families, sexual revolution. I heard, at least I was reading about in Quebec, where they had what they called the Quiet Revolution in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And this was, I was reading about it. I haven't really heard much about it. And I just, oh, this is interesting because it sounds very much, you know, like the liberal great society, you know, these government programs coupled with the sort of social upheaval and moral degeneracy being promoted.
Yes, that's exactly correct. I mean, Quebec is an extremely poignant example. I mean, because Quebec, before the so-called quiet or silent revolution, was in fact the most Catholic place in the world. It was by church attendance, statistically by demographics, it was the most religious Catholic place in the entire world. And it has gone from being the most Catholic place in the whole world, literally more Catholic than Rome, to being predominantly atheist, by and large extremely atheist. And there, as with the rest of the world, you know, Catholicism has been decimated. This is most of our listeners will be familiar, will understand if they're attentive and have listened to other excellent guests on our Interesting Times or listened to episodes of Mysterium Fasces. They will know and be aware of the cultural revolution that took place in the West, just as it did in the East, that in both communist and capitalist systems, there was a very similar cultural revolution, which took place right around the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And the products of this cultural revolution, whereas in the East it was death, in the West it is sort of infertility, which is death of another variety.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a sort of a slow burn or slow death where you somehow some of the materialism, a lure of the West, and to get them to get obsessed with things like sex and these things. And then once you have them controlled by that, you can enslave them because they lose their if you become obsessed with sexual liberty or sexual freedom, you become atomized and you no longer form the families. Those families form the communities. And then pretty soon you're pretty easily manipulated by the powers that be that control the levers of cultural power, you know, Madison Avenue, Hollywood, and these things. But it was interesting that, you know, an area like Quebec could go to such a dramatic change in such a short period of time. And it basically, it went from being a confessional state to like a typical, a liberal Western republic, more or less, right? I mean,
yeah, more or less.
Yeah. And this was all done under the guise of modernism, liberty, and these things, and liberalizing these things. And also, you know, increasing government intervention. And you know, as the church was pushed aside, the state filled the vacuum. And
right, indeed. You know, there's the conflation of high, you know, the European style socialist progressive conceit of the conflation of government involvement in big state activity with civility. Mm-hmm. Which is certainly not the case.
No.
right. And so, I mean, you know, Quebec, in a sense, like, you know, it really had its own sort of French revolution. It was just silent, it was quiet, with much less blood. Although perhaps you can make an argument with abortions that there was a great deal of blood, just simply occult blood, hidden blood.
But it's funny because it's ironic because I guess a lot of the Quebecers, they descended from, I guess, people who had either escaped France or were spared the ravages of the French Revolution simply because of geography, I guess, right? And the British protected at the time, the agreement with the British.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and the term for the original settlers of Quebec is habitant, and this literally means peasant. Okay, mm-hmm. People have heard of the Montreal Canadiens; they're known as the Habs. This is like literally slang for peasant or yokel. Okay, see, and so what happened is that and especially after very famously Battle of the Plains of Abraham during the Seven Years' War, Montcalm lost to General Wolfe, and the British took control over Quebec. The French aristocracy that had governed the colony, the upper class left. They went back to the other French colonies in Louisiana, in Acadia and ultimately back to France itself, leaving kind of just a truncated peasant population within Quebec, and which the British put under their protection because they realized that they could not effectively ethnically cleanse such a large area. That is not the same as what happened in the Maritimes, in the French colonies in the Maritimes and in Acadia. There was, in fact, wide-scale ethnic cleansing of the French, many of whom, including some of my ancestors, were deported to Louisiana.
Oh, it's interesting. Wow. Okay. At some point in the this traumatic, same thing, you know, in the United States, of course, you had the 1965 Immigration Reform Bill, which started bringing in mass immigration from non-European, non-Western countries. Because at the time, I think it was promised that this would not change the demographics of the country.
Yes, that was the bold-faced lie.
Yeah. But it did, and so, but now if you pointed out that it did exactly what it said it wasn't going to do, you're a nativist, you're a racist, if you're concerned about these things, even though the fact the law was passed under those terms, you know.
Yeah. Right, yes, no, exactly. It was a Janus-faced law, if there has ever been one. And in Canada, I mean, the nature of the Trudeau government at the time and the nature of Canada as an organization, these were less explicit. Because Canada, kind of in contrast to the United States always had a kind of a civic imperialist government, and the WASP class was much more deeply entrenched throughout most of the British colonies in the Eastern Seaboard. Whereas in Canada, from the very, very beginning, it has always been heterogeneous. The Maritime colonies are radically different from Quebec, which is radically different from Ontario, which is radically different from Manitoba, which is radically different, again, from the Western provinces. And so, I mean, an expression is, you know, I like to use is that, you know, the Hanseatic League is more of a nation than Canada is. I'm a nationalist, but because Canada does not exist, I am not a Canadian nationalist.
Yeah, it's much the same way the United States is. It's a, you know, a proposition nation, as they say. So you don't
That's the thing is it's a couple of steps down from that because it's a purely economic union. And this is explicit because the vast majority of the territory of Canada was once held by the Hudson's Bay Company, literally a British private crown corporation. And so it was explicitly set up basically as a holding zone for its vast primary resources.
So in the long term, it's inherently unstable. Because as economics change, and they are changing, you're going to see this change in demographics. It was facilitated by, you know, easing regulation regarding immigration in these things in the 1960s and 70s, liberal governments, Trudeau governments in that period, coupled with the Cultural Revolution. And this is where you have the, you know, the numbers coming into the country, the immigrants coming into the country, but it's aggravated because somehow the Canadians themselves have lost the, zest to procreate. And that wasn't just by accident. This thing was, this type of demoralization and anti-natalist, anti-family agenda was being promoted by the highest levels of, you know, of culture, of the culture makers in government at the time. Same thing in the United States.
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, to go back to Greater Vancouver kind of as a case study, so the serious aficionados of history will know of the border disputes between the British government and the United States during the 1840s over the Washington Territory. And during the 1840s was when the first sort of serious Western immigration and colonization of the Pacific Northwest occurred, and there was border skirmishes and fights between Yankees and British and so forth. But eventually the border was divided at the 49th parallel, where it continues to stand today. But serious exploitation and development of the region did not occur until the early 20th century with the laying down of the railroad. Very famously established the land connection all the way from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific. So this is where we actually saw the first wave of Chinese immigration. Many people know that they were brought in as coolie laborers. So this is, I mean, a fantastic example, that mass immigration and coolie labor is intimately connected with international capitalism, because it comes from the fact that they will not pay white men a decent wage to engage in hard labor. And I think that was a very famous statistic, something to the effect of that in the South in the 1850s, the profit margins on slavery were actually lower than the railroad. And so the railroad actually had a higher degree of exploitation of labor in terms of compensation and surplus capital than direct chattel slavery.
Wage slavery. You can make the same case of the industrial laborers in the North relative to the slaves in the South. Yeah, where you could bring in the Irish that had been forced out of Ireland by the British because of the Great Hunger, and now you have these Irish teaming into the Northeast, and they can fill the factories and the ranks of the Union Army to crush the South. All that cheap labor, mm-hmm. Yeah, and conditions in the factories were deplorable in the North. And arguably, at least much worse than any conditions that people labored in the South.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed.
But you see this leveraging of cheap labor brought about by, things like forced famines in Ireland or civil wars that are being perpetrated by the British government in China. So it creates an instability, which creates this diaspora or this surplus labor. Desperate that you can then exploit. This is like neoliberalism, right? Of course, back then it maybe wasn't neo, but
yes, indeed.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just classical liberalism, indeed. Yeah. So this is what happened. And so the railroad came into British Columbia in the early part of the 20th century, and this is when you had a serious mass colonial expansion on behalf of the various, it was predominantly British. Predominantly Anglo-Scottish, some kind of Ukrainian and German and so forth, especially in the interior. But in the lower mainland, in the greater Vancouver area, it was very, very Anglo. And so being a frontier colony, a Western colony by its very nature, is going to be more atomized, and it's going to have shallower roots than established colonies mm-hmm. back in the East. And because it was settled by kind of an Anglo population, which had been nuclearized, which had its sort of extended family and ethnic cohesion already, I would say, by this point, severely decayed, sort of the community integration was already at a much lower level than it was in the traditional non-Anglo communities out East or in various Irish or Ukrainian or German communities. That settled the Midwest of Canada and the United States. And so, as I remarked on my talk, the Pacific Northwest and Greater Vancouver is some of the finest land in the entire world. It is extremely fertile. It is extremely productive. It is extremely rich in natural resources. The weather is very, very fine, quite mild. It is very strategically located. It has an abundance of deep water ports. It is the perfect strategic location for any sort of European expansion into the Bering Sea and into the North Pacific. And so it is really a gem of a place. And so we've gotten in this situation where literally from in this the span of 100 years from initial mass colonization. Let's say like 1914 to now, it has been lost ethnically and in terms of capital to Chinese and to other kind of Oriental powers because of fundamentally the cultural degeneration, the spiritual moral degeneration of the people that lived there that had no will to reproduce, to form organic families that could in a basic level combat that had no societal organization or cohesion to lobby against this mass economic exploitation and this and so forth, and the fact that they had the decadent and corrupt elites which not only facilitated but actively promoted this degeneration and engaged in these policies of mass immigration and unrestricted capital movement that created such a situation to begin with.
It sort of became what E. Michael Jones would say, a gay disco.
mm-hmm. Very well said. Honestly, I feel like every day I preach the evangel of E. Michael Jones, speaking of him to someone who has never heard of him and mentioning his many books and so forth.
Go forth, I'm like.
Go forth and preach libido dominandi.
Yeah, yeah, that's a basic understanding of that libido dominandi is the sexual revolution of sexual freedom as political control, as the terms of slave. You're liberated sexually, but you're actually quite frankly enslaved to your passions, which means you can be manipulated very easily. And you, at the same time, you erode those relations and institutions, which actually will exercise freedom. It's the it's atomization, which we're easily enslaved. It's, you know, but it's where you have functioning institutions, families, extended families, communities, which, you know, seem to present some sort of prescriptive limits on your choices. But in the full, in the final analysis, that's the only way that you can actually function freely, because you need those corporate, you know, relationships to defend yourself against the you know, the state, the corporate state, you know, which is organized.
Yes, yes.
They're not atomized.
Yeah. No, they are not. They are highly disciplined. Well, that's perhaps high praise. They are a semi-disciplined corporate entity, which is very good at engaging in organized violence and spending money.
They can flood your neighborhood with drugs and pornography and all types of psychological warfare, and send transvestites in your schools to teach your kids how this is great, and the atomized families can do nothing because there's no basis for organization. And they don't, like in the maybe instance of many Canadians, is they don't have a basis of a religious moral doctrine to oppose this stuff. At the very least, if you have some religious moral doctrine, you have some immediate reference to be outraged. But the liberal has no immediate reference to be outraged by this stuff, because we all have to be tolerant. That's the only, that's the only virtue is tolerance
in our society. That's the moral paradigm. Yeah. And I remember I had a guy who commented on my video, and he made a very brilliant comment, and he asked me, he said that if Christianity has been such a traditional bulwark against degeneracy and decadence, then how come it was unable to stop liberalism? And I thought that, wow, okay, I'm going to think about that for a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I kind of came to the conclusion that even by the time of the 1600s, the vast majority of European states were actually not Christian in terms of their worldview or ethic or statecraft. Machiavelli and the early modernists had done away with a lot of the transcendental conceptions of sort of a Chalcedonian corporate theanthropic government. In other words, an organic, divinely transcendental state. I think you recently had the gentleman from Myth of the 20th Century on your podcast.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, fantastic podcast. One of my very favorites next to yours. And they recently did an excellent, excellent program, which I cannot commend enough, on the issue of white slavery.
Oh, yeah, I listened to that one. That was very good, yeah.
Very good. And, you know, they go into the history and they talk about how, you know, in the 15th century, you know, there's records of, you know, Venetians selling 200 English eunuchs, which they castrated themselves, to Muslim slave traders in Constantinople. Mm-hmm. So that is not the behavior of Christian men.
Yeah, and of course, Venice had long become a very capitalist oriented, city state, and they had no moral guidance to their behavior other than profit and loss,
Indeed. Yeah, and so by the time you get to early 20th century, Western Canadian Anglo religiosity, it's vapid. You've got the inertia, a little bit of inertia of religious consciousness that impels people towards avoiding some of the uglier vices to save face. Mm-hmm. That's about it.
But with Canada, you have the influx of these immigrants. Of course, in the United States, I think it was the Jacob Javits law bill. So, I don't know if you draw any conclusions from that. What they're saying is, I guess what the elite say in Canada is that, welcome to all. We're a liberal society. We can tolerate all. And is there any idea or any sense that there's any attempt to assimilate these people, or just simply no way? And in your opinion, does that ethnicity prevent proper assimilation?
Yeah, well, I would say, you know, there's a couple of things here. A, number one, the policy in Canada of multiculturalism is distinct from that in the United States because there is no civic nationalist spirit. They describe it literally as a mosaic of multiculturalism, where you explicitly want the immigrating groups to retain their ethnic identity and culture while speaking sort of the – like at the most speaking the English language and believing in Canadian – you know, liberal bourgeois values and not being too offensive to polite society. And so it's quite explicit that no, people are encouraged, non-white migrants to this country are encouraged to retain their ethnic identity and cohesion so long as that is not extremely inconvenient or incompatible with liberal values. But even that is we are seeing rapidly that that's not enforced because your Sharia law courts in Ontario, Sharia law family courts have the same status as regular family courts.
Yeah. So how do they, I mean, I don't think this is naivete. Maybe on some level it was, but obviously I think there's malevolence here because this, looking at this situation, there's simply no way that a unified polity can tolerate multiple cultures because you have to have some unifying beliefs in order to have a society, have a community. Maybe if it was highly decentralized, but then again, you're just dealing with sovereign states at that point, and what's, it's not going
to
work.
Yeah, right, exactly. And so this comes back to the fundamental reality is that Canada never existed as a nation. It never has. It never will. There were a couple of glimmers right after World War One. Maybe when there was the formation of a nascent pan-Canadian Anglo identity out of the fires of World War One and sort of the mass mobilization patriotism that created. But that was sort of quickly dashed against the stone in the aftermath of World War Two and the Cultural Revolution that was experienced.
Yeah, I mean, because you have the demographics that support that type of idea or notion. I mean, you have high birth rates that you saw in the middle part of the 20th century. And just the sort of the cultural presumptions were that this is us. This is, if it's 85-90% white, it's not going to have the same problem than if it's 50% Chinese or East Asian and these things in some of these areas. But this gets in the issue of demographics and politics. Is we're supposed to be a liberal society that is diversity is our strength, as some say, and
yes indeed.
We have a pluralistic society, as they say, but there's a certain inevitability with demographics and the resulting politics, or we shouldn't assume that just because that everyone shares the same liberal values, even if they immigrate to an area, that ultimately their demographics are going to determine the politics. And at the same time, the majority population is denied the language or grammar to express any misgivings or opposition to the sweeping demographic change that's unfolding, because you're a racist, right? This is the effect of the 1960s, when a white identity to the state that existed, or whiteness, became sort of pathologized.
Yeah, air quotes.
Yeah, guilt-ridden, this sort of thing. And in the United States, it was easy because of the demographics, right? Because you're dealing with a relatively small population, 10% of the population at the time, maybe 11% of the population. So the changes could be instituted without much friction as in some other nations. I also find interesting that South Africa itself in the late 19th century was at least the areas that were settled by the that Dutch, the Afrikaner, the Boer settlers, were destabilized by the British bringing in cheap labor
at the time. Yeah, very, very explicitly.
So you kind of see that all over the place. And then also you have the demographic problems, and of course that's aggravated by the fact that they became the minority, 10-12% of the population. So we're dealing with demographics here, and I mean, I'll ask you to say, demographics, how does it matter in politics? And if it does matter, are not those of certain ethnic groups have a right to maybe reverse policies that are undermining their own numbers in order to stabilize the political situation or preserve certain political values they deem essential to a liberal constitution, like rule of law, respect for freedom of speech and these things, which aren't exactly universal values if you look around the world, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, demographics are, in fact, destiny. This is can be universally demonstrated throughout history. There are, you know, a few exceptions to this, you know, what I'm, you know, but those always have, you know, successful cosmopolitanism is always built on the back of a dominant ethno-linguistic religious identity with a strong central monarchical figure. Mm-hmm. And under those situations, some sort of soft cosmopolitanism can be successful, such as in the Roman Empire, various Indian empires, various Chinese empires, and so forth. But even then, it's a bit of a stretch. So in the West, I mean, what we've seen is that, you know, one can go and look up for themselves the voting patterns of various immigrant groups. We see that they vote uniformly in majority, typically 70%+ for various liberal or social democratic parties. And the reason that is because those parties engage in a patron-client relationship with these ethnic groups in these ethnic neighborhoods. And represent their interests, and they know that they can have their interests accurately represented, and they can get their piece of the pie by supporting and casting their lots in with these cultural revolutionaries. And so, I mean, where are you going to begin with this? I mean, so this is just the reality. I mean, again, there's not a lot of opinion behind the discussion of demographics, because it is a science, and you can count and survey people pretty accurately based on their ethnic background and their political affiliation. And we see this reproduced very consistently across the Western world, where immigrant client groups are represented at a state level and are given their economic bursaries by social revolutionaries. So it's no different in Canada. And so in the greater Vancouver area, you have several of these demographics. The primary ones are – well, there's three basically main demographics in terms of minority population or majority population in some of these places. You have Chinese. You have Muslim, specifically from the Indian subcontinent, so Pakistani and Indian Muslim, Arabs to a lesser degree. And then you have other people from the Indian subcontinent, so Sikhs. There are some Hindus, but Sikhs are extremely predominant in the greater Vancouver area. And so another one of the Vancouver suburbs that I discussed is the city of Surrey. The city of Surrey is 45% Indian, as in from the Indian subcontinent. And I think it's like 15 to 20% Sikh. In many of these communities, so like the Sikhs, for instance, are an extremely ethnically coherent group. They can be compared to Jews in terms of their level of ethnic coherence. And I don't use that term in this particular instance disparagingly. I think that the Sikhs have got a lot of good stuff figured out, because they basically – their whole religion was created in response to the invasion of the Mughal Empire. And it was created as a religion of – warriors in economic, religious, ethnic solidarity who exist to fight Muslims. that is why they exist. With Sikhs, what you find is that if they're around their temples, their gurdwaras, they have the community of the militant faithful called the Khalsa. And this is the body of social organization for religious Sikhs. So Sikhs that are inside of the Khalsa, that are religious, by definition, that are warriors, you are a member of the Khalsa, tend to actually be pretty honorable people and upstanding businessmen. Some of them are uncivilized just by nature of their background, but many of them are fairly civilized. Sikhs and Punjabis who are not in the Khalsa are almost universally rapacious bandits. And a lot of the gang violence which is occurring in the city of Surrey and in Vancouver at large is from these sort of apostate Punjabi populations. And so this kind of brings back to the issue that, I mean, of course, I mean, if you presume that the indigenous ethnic population of a country or a population that has won such a country by right of conquest or colonization, and I should be clear that I don't believe in colonialism or imperialism, you know, life is life and history unfolds a certain way. You sort of have to deal with situations as you're given them. Of course, I have a vested interest in not being ethnically and capitally displaced in their own homelands. and that so that their children don't have to pay $2 million for a four-bedroom house in the city that their ancestors founded 80 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. But the here's an, you know, you talk about, you know, certain politics follows demographics, and but we're told that we can't consider race or ethnicity in politics, you know, or we can't be when we hear things like if you're a white American, you know, a European American of European descent, German, Dutch, Irish, you know, mixture, whatever most white Americans are now, and you hear this saying that, you know, America, you know, white population will be a minority population by the year 2075. And that's going to be it's going to represent a sudden, you know, not a sudden, but a significant change in what America is and its culture. And you hear that, you're thinking, okay, what if I don't want that change and I have to act politically to reverse that change? That's a legitimate political position to take. Do I have to then reverse the demographic trends? And if that is the case, what action do I have to take to reverse demographic trends? That would be maybe restricting immigration, changing immigration laws, promoting a different type of culture that promotes sort of maybe ethnic identity and ethnic cohesiveness, but then you come off sounding like a racist because that language now could, so to defend ethnicity now makes you a racist. Only if you're white, though. By the way, only if you're white.
Right. Of course.
Yeah.
Well, that's the nature of the political control is that they can by the introduction of epistemological nominalism. The separation of words from the reference, that you know, thing concepts such as justice or nation or law no longer have a sort of transcendental thought form or logos to them that can be appealed to without relativization. Once the concept is introduced, that means that whoever is rich and powerful can control language because they have the most influence. And especially with the advent of mass media, this has been observed most emphatically. And so what happens is if you can control the language, you can control the moral paradigm, you can control the moral frame. And so people don't even have the words or to think outside of that control system, which is prescribed. And so that's the thing. So to combat such a system of control, you have to step outside of the moral frame entirely. And so when, you know, when people say you're a Nazi, you're a racist, you have to respond with, I don't care.
Yes, I don't care anymore. I really don't care. I know I'm not what you think that is, because I don't think you know what a Nazi is anyway, but because you just been given the Hollywood version, but I'm not a Nazi. I know what I am. But I'm saying, two examples of what I'm talking about here is this is something that's very uncomfortable because as an American who believes in like liberalism, right? Or I was taught to believe in liberalism and freedom of choice and these things. All these are fine within a moral framework. I mean, in order to have these choices, you have to defend the moral framework, the moral order. And these aren't being assaulted. Liberty is assaulting the moral order. And then we find we have neither because liberty depends on a moral order ultimately. I think you're aware, and I did a recent talk with Joe Atwell about the promotion of race mixing in the media. Mm-hmm. Now, it's completely disproportionate what's really happening. And so at this point, I go from not being sort of laissez-faire and not being too concerned about who marries who, because people make their own decision, these things. But when you're dealing with the reality of social engineering and psychological warfare, then you're dealing with a malevolence. There is a system, an instrumentality that's targeting you and targeting your community, targeting your family. Then you start to see, hey, what's going on here? And in the talk, we talked about how, first of all, it's a lot less common than represented the media. But at the same time, that it's presented as progressive, modern, sort of sexy to be race mixing in these things, and at the same time they're promoting race mixing, they're promoting it along with moral degeneracy, sexual liberalism, and these things. Good example is if you look at the numbers, 90% of all babies, white women that have babies with black fathers are illegitimate. They never get married.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That is a catastrophe. And given the fact that black culture in the United States has been so debased by social engineering, and I've talked about how this was done, particularly in the 1960s with the Great Society and these things, they took a sort of a community that was marginalized and weak, and actually at the same time they're giving it political rights, they're undermining its moral basis. So basically, as they got the voting rights law, everyone lost their fathers, and what do you have? You know, you're better off having a father than having a right for a meaningless vote. But I'm saying, so what happened if they asked most whites what their view of mixed marriages are, black, white, and they say, well, 85% approve or indifferent to it. But at the same time, 65% are opposed to illegitimacy. But the problem is if the function of black white mixing, particularly black father white mother, is 90% illegitimacy, then at the end the logic of the very thing produces the very thing you're supposedly against. You see what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah. Of course. Yeah. It was funny, in fact, on our last talk that we did, I thought the comments were very amusing, because I guess it was a little controversial, and I think that. And I think it was specifically the comments that we had made about homosexualism, libidominandi, but also the issue of miscegenation and like race war, and that kind of thing, which is kind of shocking language. It gets people's feathers in a ruffle. But I thought I'd kind of clear things out by stating pretty explicitly what my position is. I mean, I'm an Orthodox Christian, and so I don't believe. I mean, I believe in the universal. Human image of man, and I believe that man's salvation is not determined by his ethnicity or the mixed ethnicity thereof or anything like that.
Yeah, you don't believe in the mysticism of race is that
right? No, indeed. But it's an obvious fact that race is a biologically demonstrable reality, and the scripture and church tradition is extremely clear that God has set up these nations and delineates their borders, and He does that for His glory. And so the issue with racial mixing is that it can be very empirically demonstrated that it's extremely damaging and harmful for the children. Yes. That even in situations of legitimate marriages, let's say between white Asian couples, where you have very, very high rates of legitimacy, the children and the products of these unions have just spectacularly higher rates of mental illness, of identity issues, of unemployment, of incarceration. Of drug abuse, of poor academic achievement, all of these sort of, so you think Elliot Rodger types so and so forth. So all of these negative markers, even when there is an intact sort of nuclear family.
Yeah.
And this is just the product of being interracial, being mongrelized, basically, because you don't have a firm footing in any one of your backgrounds. And when you come from an ethnic background that is so heterogeneous and disparate, it does not mesh easily. I mean, in the case of Asians, I mean, like, even if you were half Chinese, half Japanese, you would have a huge issue, much less half Japanese, half white, or half Chinese, half white. And so when we get to the issue with blacks, who have all of these issues where that dissonance and disparity is so extreme, and you have these levels of illegitimacy, the product is universally negative. Mm-hmm. The statistic, 90% illegitimacy, that means that it's statistically negligible, the level of legitimacy in marriage. So you can make a claim that is statistically speaking universally negative.
Yeah, and the women that are doing this are in effect being ghettoized. They're it's downward mobility for them. I mean, they're not raising.
Well, I've had the particular. I have spent some time recently in American Walmarts out of necessity.
You see what I'm talking about?
Yes, and it's a very existential experience every time I go into an American Walmart, and the stereotypes are unfortunately very, very true, and you see these sort of frumpy fat white chicks with their mulatto babies and these, Irish grannies with their mulatto grandchildren and, where's dad, right?
Yeah.
He's not in the picture or he's incarcerated, unfortunately.
Yeah. And that's, and to me, and it's like, that's a legitimate concern. It's not like you're in, like I said, I'm not in the business of telling people who they should fall in love with, or if they want to call it that in some of the situations, who they hook up with. But when you see these numbers, like, well, yeah, you know, the community has a stake here. They have an interest here in promoting social order and the moral order, and you have these people behaving like this, especially when, you know, many of them are going on welfare. I think 85%, if I have if I remember that correct, of children born of black fathers and white mothers are on welfare of some form or another. That's how bad it is.
Right. Just because there's no economic basis to sort of a black breadwinner family. I mean, so this is another sort of very, very interesting set of statistics. Has to do with small business ownership and social mobility under Jim Crow versus under non-Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's basically the long and the short is when blacks lived in their own segregated societies, they had their own all-black businesses. And so the rates of small business ownership, of economic mobility, sort of a bourgeois middle-class success were astronomically higher than they are now.
They could develop on their own. And even Malcolm X made those observations. Yeah.
Well, this is it. I mean, yeah. Some of the greatest resources, some of the men who are most on the side of our arguments are black nationalists.
Yes.
Now, some of them do, in fact, think that we are blue-eyed devils.
Yeah.
Who
that, are
cool.
They have that baggage. Yeah. I've had people who have dealt with them, and they find them to be above board and easy to deal with because they're reliable, they're honorable. You know, they know.
Yes, indeed. And honesty is always preferable to dishonesty.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, if you're dealing with somebody who is overt about the fact that he thinks that you are, a devil wearing flesh, but he's willing to be honest with you, this is infinitely preferable to the snake who will shake your hand and stab you in the back.
It's also a recipe for peace in the community.
Yes.
Because
under such circumstances, both parties understand what they basically want is to be separate and to not engage in gunfights and do their own business.
Well, they want an arena of, you know, this of multiple ethnicities living in a, you know, because the elites know they'll be constantly fighting out. They'll be fighting each other and dividing, and they won't, you know, so that's what they want. They don't want stable communities that can organize and represent the interest of each group. And then you have to bargain with them. In this case, you don't have to bargain with anybody because they're all atomized and they're all fighting each other in the arena. And they're watching it, you know, from the bleachers.
Divide and conquer.
Yeah. Another example is the I read an article, and this is kind of funny. It was a couple of years ago in the Washington Post, I think, about the National Rifle Association. And this is right after one of these shootings, I think one in the Oregon Community College back in 2015. This is written by Adam Winkler, and he's talking about the demographics are going against the National Rifle Association. And he says, support for an opposition to gun control is closely associated with several demographic characteristics, including race, level of education, whether one lives in a city. Nearly all are trending forcefully against the NRA. The core of the NRA's support comes from white, rural, relatively low-educated voters. This demographic is currently influential in politics, but clearly on the wane. While the decline of white, rural, and less educated Americans is generally well known, less often recognized is what this. Skip ahead here. Polls show that whites tend to favor gun rights over gun control by a significant margin, 57% to 40%. Yet whites, who comprise 63% of the population today, won't be in the majority for long. Racial minorities are soon to be a majority, and they are the nation's strongest supporters of strict gun laws. An overwhelming majority of African Americans say that gun control is more important than gun rights, 72% to 24%, while African-American population shows signs of slow growth. Other racial minority groups are growing more rapidly and report even greater support for gun control. The fastest-growing minority group in America is Latinos. Between 2000 and 2010, the nation's Latino population grew by 43%. Hispanics, which make up 70% of the population today, are expected to grow to 30% of the population in the coming decades. Gun control is extremely popular among Hispanics, with 75% favoring gun safety over gun rights. Same with Asian Americans. So what they're saying is that the support for, say, the Second Amendment, or perhaps the First Amendment, perhaps the Fourth Amendment, you know, the Third, whatever, support for the Constitution, rule of law, is kind of a white thing. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So if that is the case, and I'm looking at that, and they're saying that, and the nation's sort of demographic transformation in the next 30, 40 years is going to result in a qualitative shift in the nation's politics and how it's going to affect me, my children, their grandchildren. And this is demographically driven. Okay, if that is the case, then I am justified in trying to reverse that those demographics and in promoting higher birth rates among whites, among certain communities, and reversing things like immigration, right? And at least that's a legitimate thing to say. But then again, if I voice that opposition or discomfort the idea that whites are a declining population or percentage of the population in the United States, and that might change, might result in a reduction in quality of life in the United States, I'm a racist. But this guy Adam Winkler is admitting that. So I'm in a double bind here.
Yes, exactly. Thus, the necessity of removing oneself entirely from the moral paradigm which produces such a situation. And so this kind of comes back to the crux of the matter. So what is one to do? You realize this is the problem. You realize that you are part of this victimized group, whether you like it or not. And, you know, you are about to bear, and your children especially, the ones that are about to be born, will bear the full brunt of the economic and political and spiritual disenfranchisement and soon oppression by various other hostile powers, internal and external. Well, my personal opinion is I think that there are two essential things which need to occur for any sort of serious return to an organic and just government or state or society. First of all, there needs to be a change in the heart of men. Far and away, this is the most important thing, that Corneliu Zelia Codrianu, the leader of the Iron Guard in Romania, had a very famous quote, which goes something like this: Jews are like mosquitoes. As mosquitoes can only settle in noxious swamps, so Jews can only settle in the swamps of our sins. The same principle can be applied to any parasitical group, where when a society becomes undisciplined, when it becomes full of vice, when it loses its virtue, it can be easily exploited by any type of predator, hostile population, whether it's a Turk or a Jew or a Chinaman or any unscrupulous business actor or themselves or their own corrupt elite. And so fundamentally, what is necessary is to change man's moral paradigm. He needs to convert in his heart and in his mind. This is what needs to occur. And so my personal opinion is that the most effective way that this can be done is the reintroduction of traditional liturgies into European communities in the West, because a traditional liturgy provides the entire semiotic language, the entire symbolic cosmological worldview. It's right there to give you access to that transcendental reality, that deifying grace, which is the fount and the source of all virtues, and which enables one to break in a real way from the false illusion, the glamour, this demonic glamour of the kind of propaganda reality. So that would be step number one, basically. And without this step, nothing else can be done. Because, I mean, even if you want to discuss the possibility of some sort of armed insurrection or some sort of organized political violence against the great Satan, against the sort of Babylonian state, well, you know, cowards do not pick up rifles.
No,
there's no such thing as an unfanatical martyr.
I want to address something about the Iron Guard leader, Corleanu, right? Pronounce that right?
Codrianu.
Yeah, he said, you know, it's funny because he's putting the onus on the host population there, not on the exploiters, right? And I was recently heard someone was talking about I think it was Jewish comedians, and some, you know, they get into, you know, the dirty jokes they tell and how it corrupts the audience. And I think it was, I forget, may have been Lenny Bruce, I forget who it was, but someone asked him why he does the type of humor he does. He says, well, because it gets laughs, you see. Yeah. And it's meaning that it there's a dialectic here. You can go overboard in blaming a certain group for, you know, for exploiting the weakness, but the bottom line is the people have to consent to it, right?
Right.
You know, you have to allow Dracula to come on in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Right, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, this is the fundamental reality. And so all of this comes back to theology. And that this is essentially the point of Mysterium Fasces. This is the whole purpose of the podcast. It's just to illustrate that there can be no political philosophy without theology. It's all theological, and you're theological whether you want to or not. I mean, if you believe that things exist and that the conversations that we have meaning and logical content to them, then you are already a theologian whether you realize it or not. it's the long and the short, right?
Yeah.
And so this is it. So the second major issue in the North American context, aside from kind of the reformation of the hearts of men, is what is necessary is the collapse of the United States and Canadian federal entities and the dissolution of these economic unions into smaller, more organic constituent parts. Because I just don't – they're not – they're basically just big economic unions. It's a big corporation. It's a big oligarchy.
Yeah.
And so within such a context, there can be no discussion of real policy. There can be – because real policy or an organic government which emanates from the people and exists to serve them and whose whole purpose is centered around the common good of the people from which that government is derived can only exist in a localized or sort of pan-local sort of provincial context, national context.
You're talking about a human scale of politics, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. And so this is one of the unfortunately one of the unnatural decadences of high industrialization is the creation of mass polities where, you know, I mean things like mass propaganda are necessary in order to compete, right? This is traditionally one of the failings of conservatives and reactionaries and monarchists is they considered to engage in propaganda was something dirty, was something vulgar and low and crass. You know, I think in Russia, before the revolution, there was one monarchist newspaper. There was one, and I think they published monthly. There was over 300 communist and socialist newspapers.
And let me guess, that after the revolution, they didn't allow that one newspaper to persist, did they?
No.
They only speak tolerance when it, you know, when it suits them, and then the moment they get in power, they shut everything down. Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah. And yeah, I guess their final, that paper could be brought back, the editorial could have been, "We told you so," right?
Yes. Yes, something to that effect.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, that's the thing is I honestly believe that without these two sort of prerequisites, there can be no system of organized policy change that will have any serious effect. Now, so what that basically means is from a political standpoint, especially in a democratic system, you're screwed. So you need to start to look for other solutions. And I think that the first and foremost primary solution is spiritual. Man needs to reform his heart. And then once he has begun the process of repentance, you need the cultivation of virtue, the expulsion of vice, which is always a struggle. It's a struggle until you die. Well, there is, in fact, a polity that you have direct control over, and that's the family.
Mm-hmm.
And within the context of the family and the greater familial household, you can actually actualize all of the cultural policies that you want to see. You can control directly what kind of economic interactions occur, you know, what kind of agricultural, you know, what your children eat, you know, what kind of culture you engage in, what your routine is like.
Florent, we know that's where the authoritarian personality derives, right?
That's Ur-fascism. That's, you know, wow, belief in absolute truth. Wow. Yeah.
That's fascism.
You might, that's fascism. That's fascism. Yeah. So I suppose Mysterium Fasces, aptly named.
But you have to, again, those families have to first cohere, and people have to have the right expectations of sex roles, mother, father. Isn't parenting, there's mother, fathering, and how they relate to one another. And all these things, of course, have been under assault for so many decades that many people no longer even recognize it or aspire to it, you know.
Right, or the very concept itself of you know, of male and female, right, is being destroyed. I mean, in the next sort of stage of the Cultural Revolution is to destroy the very concept of fertility, like pedophilia, basically.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you know, and I've done a podcast on transhumanism. You know, when you sort of get into the Masonic nominalist mindset, where if the entire world is this kind of dead matter which was created by the grand architect of the universe out of the wisdom of his mind, then a man's body being a reflection of such an architect is also subject to modification and rearrangement and change at the whim of the initiated magus. And so this is Aldous Huxley's last lecture at Berkeley he gave on entitled The Human Revolution, you know, on this very subject. And he is very, very explicit that this is exactly what will occur, is that man himself will be revolutionized. His essential biology and spirit will be changed and will be altered through the use of technology and pharmaceuticals and cultural shifts, etc. And so the goal is to destroy the image of God in man. That is precisely it, to kill his free will, to destroy his rational mind, which separates him from an animal, to turn him into, at best, cattle, at worst, a demon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this began long ago. Of course, I think in the West it began with the Enlightenment, where man became the measure of all things. He was just guided by reason, right? And there was no—
Right. I mean, I think you could even make the argument, it goes back to William of Ockham, first formalized nominalism, right? And mm-hmm. then the controversies between, you know, the Thomistic metaphysical realists and the nominalists in the Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm. But now it's playing out in a modern era. I did a recent show, and I learned that in California, in Santa Barbara, the school district there has for second graders, I guess, sort of a profile and courage, or people look up to. And they used to have Abraham Lincoln, which, again, is problematic, but that's, you know, the sort of
true.
Typical history that kids got. But what isn't immediately offensive? You don't see it and go, oh, okay.
Right, of course. But he's a fairly vigorous figure at the minimum.
Yeah, at the minimum, okay. So, apparently they switched out Abraham Lincoln as someone to emulate to some politician there who was first transvestite politician. Who came out?
Yes.
This is for second graders. This is someone they should look mm-hmm. up to and emulate because of his honesty. He was honest about himself, and it wasn't honest the fact that he was a confused person, and needing some sort of spiritual or psychological help. But he was actually a hero, and this is mm-hmm. as problematic as that is for anybody to introduce that to anybody. They're doing it to kids who are in second grade.
This is precisely it.
And that is out and out demonic, satanic to do that. And in fact,
right. I think the best resource we can look to for how this is going to play out is Aldous Huxley in mm-hmm. Brave New World. And I think that the greatest, and I give full credit to Jay Dyer for this insight. The greatest credit is that with Aldous Huxley, once you realize that 1984 and kind of Brave New World, these are kind of the twin dystopian novels, yeah. and people apply the same hermeneutic to Brave New World as they did in 1984, that this is written as like a cautionary tale, as a warning. but once you realize that Aldous Huxley, no, this is what he wanted. This is what he's promoting. This is his ideal future. Then everything begins to make a lot more sense. And so this is exactly what we see in Brave New World is the sexualization of children, mm-hmm. right?
And that's what it is. And the irony is you'll hear everyone's talking about scandals within the Catholic Church, clerical sex scandals. They're calling it pedophilia, although in many cases this is homosexuality. That's not really strictly right. pedophilia. Hollywood's pedophilia, but no one's really talking about that, right? I heard a sidebar or a digression here, but I was watching an old Saturday Night Live clip. I think they were doing their weekend update thing and news set segment, and they had that guy Seth. What was his name? Seth something. I forget his last name. And Jason Sudeikis, who's playing the devil, and devil's come on to talk about recent news, and He says, "Yeah, we got a scandal in Pennsylvania in Penn State." He says, "Oh, what is this? Gambling with the, it was the football? Are they cheating again?" And he whispers into his ear, and he goes, "Oh, God, no! That's horrible!" Like the devil is even outraged by what, you know, what was going on at Penn State, and he says, "That's awful." He says, "This is, you know, this is college football. This isn't the Catholic Church." And he gets a cheap laugh. And I said, "Oh, that's funny." Now, Jason's a funny guy. He's a talented guy. But let's face it, if he'd been really ballsy, he would have said, "This is college football. This isn't Hollywood." Right? Because really, I mean, come on. But then he can't go against his masters. But the thing is a whole entire society, whether it's entertainment, music, the schools with sexual education and AIDS education, AIDS awareness and these things, gay rights and tolerance, it's all directed towards sexualizing young kids. And at the same time, you can't turn around and say that pedophilia is a taboo when you're promoting it by sexualizing young kids.
Right. You know? Yes, absolutely. And this is especially critical for women. Women are the particular target of these attacks because they are extremely psychologically vulnerable to sexual promiscuity. And sexual promiscuity in women destroys them. Mm-hmm. It destroys them. And the best
think those women are happy on those slut walks?
I don't know, Tim. I mean,
they're proud. They're proud that they're slut.
They're proud. I guess they're happy. I don't know. What is happiness, really? So I think that one of the most important statistics, and I'm very seriously considering printing out 100 copies of this graph and distributing it down the street, is the connection between premarital sexual partners and marriage stability and marriage intactness. Mm-hmm. And the numbers are actually – I recently looked back into it. They're even more dramatic than I thought they were.
Interesting.
Yeah. So women who enter into marriage virginally have an 80-90% marriage success rate. If they have only relations with the man who will become their husband, that moves down to 75%. If they have sort of 1 to 3 partners, it's somewhere in between 45-60%. And then what happens is after 4 partners, it goes below 40% to 30% to 20%, right, like that. And so basically, if a woman has had over 4 premarital sexual partners in her lifetime, you are playing Russian roulette with 4 to 5 chambers loaded.
And I would say that isn't the same with men. I think we both know why. I mean, men and women are different, right? I mean, by the way, this is to the woman's credit, the final analysis, because –
Yes, it is to the woman's credit, final analysis. So. Well, I mean, there's a famous quote is that, you know, a man can always give reasons for why he loves his children, and a woman does not need to give a reason.
Yes, yeah. And that sexual virtue goes with motherhood. Because through sexual virtue, the paternity is secured through the father.
And right.
Therein lies the stability. Right. I mean, you're talking about – these are fundamental – base differences that no matter ideology can upset, you know, can reverse. It can create a whole lot of pain, but eventually nature rises to the surface here. You can push it down, but it pops up. It's going to pop up in many different ways, and that's what you see there. And so it's kind of funny because, you know, you have to have these long studies when just based on, you know, people know this. To begin with, that promiscuous women aren't happy women, and they usually don't have happy lives, and that's why women got reputations, right? I mean, that this is all part of function. It goes back to paternity and these things. They immediately have the most at stake, but they're the most vulnerable to being seduced by the modern culture, treating as being free or sexually liberated. You know, hypergamy, that's the Helen Gurley Brown thing where she told women could go out and go after any man. You know, any man was fair game, and if he was engaged or married and these things. And what it really resulted in is not more sex for everybody. It's actually more sex for a few men, because you have now a lot of women chasing a few men. Whereas if you had monogamy, people have to go down the, you know, get more or less settle, for lack of a better term, because that guy's off limits now. Mm-hmm. And also creates women become, you know, opportunistic and predatorial, which we've seen now today, so many women, and which then produces Mythgal, right, which is complete societal collapse.
Yes, yes, exactly.
I mean, it's like, you know, okay. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, it was an observation, you know.
Men going the wrong way.
Was an observation that I think I made sort of in the wake of just the total collapse of the American right in the last year, was that, you know, I mean, things, you know, certainly, I mean, listeners of the show tend to be more conspiracy woke or whatever term you want to use. And I'm no exception to this reality, you know, but you get oftentimes there is a tendency to over conspirize, or I'm not sure what the term would be, to over conspirize, you know, the nature of reality, right? Yeah. And of course, as we all know, reality is personal. There's no such thing as an abstract reality. It is all personalities working together. But the reality of the collapse of the right in the United States, or the far right, whatever term you want to use, is that it kind of played out as if it could have been a COINTEL program. But you'll have to trust me as kind of someone who's an insider and who knows all the personalities and the figures. It wasn't a COINTEL program. It was the result of lack of virtue. It was because the society itself has become so so Babylonian that people just are unable to remain steady.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Where I was going with that, I thought. What were we talking about?
We were discussing the promiscuity in women and the structure of the family.
And this is where you come across, you know, this is where I've come around to thinking, is that the whole modern presupposition of what opportunity and freedom is in the United States has been a recipe for disaster. You know, women's liberation, idea of women working in these things. Now, it's funny because, you know, as men become addicted to pornography and sex obsessed, they become less reliable and less, I guess, not good candidates for breadwinners. You also have the broader economic conditions that are denying them the opportunities to be breadwinners. They've also flooded the labor markets with women, which also has reduced wages, and not immigration and immigrants and women. So now the men can no longer be, you know, used to be that if you're just hardworking with a minimal education, you could be a breadwinner for a family. You can't. That's not the case anymore. This the assumption that women need seek employment outside the home in their 20s, when they really should be having children, right?
Yes.
And this is just
I have
family members talking about women who just graduated from college and these things, and they're talking about jobs. None of them are close to getting married and having babies.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah. No. This is by design, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you're well aware, and certainly all of our listeners are well, I mean, this is exactly it. I mean, a woman's peak of fertility is, you know, between the ages of 20 and 30. That mm-hmm. is the golden period. And after, you know, 30 to 40 is doable, but suboptimal. And then after every year after 40 radically increases mm-hmm. the risk of birth defect and infertility.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're
out there working. And here's another thing: as you were talking about promiscuity in women, how it scars them is that young girls need to be somewhat protected. Would you agree?
Yes.
I mean, but now we send them off to college and, you know, by themselves, and they live on, you know, and in the campus themselves, and they become dens of iniquity where they promote the cultural Marxist sex crap and all that. But when they go into work, when a woman goes out and works in the work environment, and she's out there full time, and she's not home providing hearth and home, taking care of children, she's essentially being brutalized, being defeminized. And that sounds so sexist, but I don't care, because I'm looking at I've no problem with a woman working. I have all the respect for women. I treat them nice, all that stuff. And I'm saying the broader effect of everyone doing this, as opposed to just a minority doing it, is societal collapse. If women aren't making babies, it's societal collapse in their 20s.
It's very, very simple. And this is what it comes back to, you know, is that there's like base theology, base biology.
Mm-hmm.
If things are true and the things that we discuss have internal logic to them and reference some true things, right? These theological principles, if all of that is the correct, you know, that, and you know, you most people believe this, but just have never actually unpacked those presuppositions. If that's all true, and you acknowledge that there actually is like base biology, then it's not a matter of controversy that women are the gatekeepers of human life, of reproduction. And if women don't actually have babies, then there are no people. That is how it works.
Yeah, full stop. I think it's pretty simple. And also, another thing is, as many of women, and I think, you know, they've internalized a lot of the feminist nonsense presupposition, even among conservative women, religious women, they've internalized all this stuff, whereas they can't even recognize the fact that they think that they should be able to go out. They don't need protecting in these things because they themselves have been marginally brutalized by this stuff. They just don't recognize. We've all in a sense been brutalized and affected by it. I mean, we're all victims in a sense. I don't want to say I'm a victim. Oh, help me. I'm just saying I myself am a product of social engineering. I'm just recognizing it. You know.
Yeah, no, it sucks. You know, it sucks to be like a very vulgar man.
Yeah.
Not of your own choice. But that such are the days that we live in.
Yeah. You know, it's like I remember growing up in the 70s and 80s, it was mild compared to what's now, but I remember, you know, there was always some kid that whose father got Playboy and they'd show it to you. Right? And looking back at it, I'm not saying, you know, that scar, it affected me. How can it not affect you, right? As you're butting into a young man and these things, that changes you. And looking back at it, it did, you know, because what your expectations are, what things should look like, and, you know, even how you view women. But my point is, you know, because this stuff is allowed to be published, and I think you broached this topic in your talk on organic government, is something like obscenity laws, where in a liberal society, you can't restrict it all because we're free. It's First Amendment. And we used to have laws against this stuff. But the idea is, okay, let's say that we're going to print this stuff. And it's only going to mail in a brown paper bag to subscribers who are adults. So it won't be as bad. But once you print it, how do you control its proliferation? You can't.
Yeah, indeed. Well, and once you kind of give that imprimatur, once you give moral sanction to the printing of pornography, well, where does that moral principle come from? Because that's certainly not from freedom of speech. Okay?
Well, yeah, that's another thing. They changed the laws. The courts turned against us, turned against decent society in the 1950s with the Roth decision and the legitimization of pornography. You know, and this goes back to demographic warfare, as Michael Jones writes about in Slaughter of Cities, is because the Hollywood was more largely contained by the Catholic Church. It was deriving its strength from these Catholic urban neighborhoods that were systematically torn up in the 1950s and 60s under the guise of, well, I don't know, opportunity, the interstate highway system, and also racial integration weaponized. You know. And of course, there's no integration because it created a white flight into suburbia, where people were deracinated and they could be subjected to, you know, psychological warfare, entertainment.
Exactly. Exactly. And so kind of coming back full circle to the issue of the new colonialism. I mean, if you are victim, as probably most of our listeners are, of this new colonialism, then really the best thing that you can do is to for those of you who are not familiar, the military historian and West Point professor William S. Lind.
Oh yeah,
He's very excellent. You should try to get him on your podcast. I mean, he's just a fantastic guest.
Third generation warfare. He's one.
So to go over briefly for those of you who might not be familiar with the work of William S. Lind, he divides warfare into four different generations. The first generation is formation warfare. This is what we see in the ancient world, Alexander the Great, and so forth. Then there is basically mass warfare it has, like, you know, you think Napoleonic Wars, where the mathematical intensity of firepower is what determines victory, typically speaking, with a combination of formation. And then you have maneuver warfare, which is kind of World War II, Blitzkrieg type business. And then he makes the distinction between third generation warfare and fourth generation warfare, is that fourth generation warfare is actually not about violence. It is about commanding the primary loyalty of a particular civilian population. Because if you can command the primary loyalty, this is actually the prerequisite to engage in any organized violence at all. And so United States counterinsurgency tactics are based explicitly on an understanding of this fourth generation warfare theory and commanding the primary loyalty of occupied populations. And so, you know, if you are the head of a family, you are a leader of a fourth generation warfare entity because your children have the family as their primary loyalty. If you are a pastor of a church, a rector of a church, you are the leader of a fourth generation warfare entity because hopefully your members of your parish have the church and Jesus Christ as their the object of their primary loyalty over and above secular powers, right? And so this is what the state is really concerned about. It's concerned about controlling the moral paradigm, the moral frame, and by extension, controlling the primary loyalty of the populations within that moral frame. And so what you can do concretely, everybody can do this without exception, is you can build these fourth generation warfare entities. You can have families. You can participate in your parish community. You can work to disseminate truth. You can work even to disseminate real capital, to produce goods and services in a useful and non-serious way. All of these things, but especially it's the spiritual aspect of it, the mental aspect of it, directly attack the legitimacy of and the reality of the U.S. and Canadian state apparatuses,
yeah,
which are so wicked and evil.
And I think we're witnessing the absurdity of it all with these recent Supreme Court hearings. The political theater of it all, and
The absolute state, yeah.
They're literally going through high school yearbooks and asking about why did you write this in a yearbook? There's some joke made about flatulence or something in there. They actually have a senator asking Brett Kavanaugh about that. I don't know what the
you've got prostitutes talking about the fact that the president's penis is funny. I mean, this is.
Yeah.
This is the level of
this theater, I think, is intentionally there to further degrade society. I think the whole Lewinsky thing and looking back at Clarence Thomas and now this thing, it's just a progression. And I think this is done just so everyone's talking about it and just more nonsense, more of this degrading of society by talking. Even this is becoming, a matter of public discourse when it's just nonsense. It feeds itself. I was thinking, it was like, these Kavanaughs are, the Kavanaugh hearings are a joke, and they've made it a joke. It may not be his fault. He's just involved in it. But then, how the media cycle starts to work, it's almost self-perpetuating, because then Saturday Night Live will do a skit making fun of it, and that becomes a news story in and of itself. And people start conflating that with reality. It's almost like, I remember back when Sarah Palin was running for vice president, and Saturday Night Live had that girl doing it. Very funny. I mean, she got her accent down perfectly. But the skits became part of the sketches became part of the news cycle. Not reality. This isn't reality. And, then you have the Comedy Central, the news, those things. And it's just absolutely absurd. The utter baseness of the American system, American governmental system, is just there for all to see. I mean, it's...
I don't know. I mean... These kind of Walmart experiences I've been having have been very enlightening, because you spend time, in kind of like an integral religious community, around kind of real people, wholesome people, families, regular people, and then you go to Walmart and then you see the absolute state of the lumpen prol of our people.
Yeah.
Of how far we have been degenerated, the lowest strata of our population, and this is the thing. It kind of comes back to the essential reality of the demand for a Christian ethic, is that the Christian ethic and worldview is the only thing which is capable of repersonalizing these depersonalized individuals.
Yeah, and there is an aesthetic to this, to the Christian ethic and ideals. And you go to Walmart and you see that. You don't see much of that aesthetic. I mean, I don't know. Have you noticed the proliferation of tattoos on people?
Yeah. I mean, I think Jay Dyer was making this point. Is he said something to the it was either like Bobby Flay or Anthony Bourdain. I think it was Bobby Flay.
Yeah.
He was talking about Bobby Flay was the first chef to have like sleeve tattoos.
Yeah.
Right. And the involvement of like the Pentagon and the CIA with these professional celebrity chefs.
Yeah.
And that these sleeve tattoos became really popular among chefs. And the tattoo industry is now exploding.
Yeah. And right? I mean, I've watched them. It used to be rare. And usually it was someone who was from the military or a gang member. I mean, obviously different classes, different people who tattoos for different reasons. But now it's starting to proliferate. Now I'm at the gym and just all girls walking and she's got a snake tattooed all along her leg. And other than that, she's like a normal looking girl. I mean, she's not.
Yeah. No. Yeah, exactly. I mean, unfortunately, these tattoos often aren't even good. I mean, because it costs a couple $1,000s to get a piece of art put on your body.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, in the ancient world, there was only a few categories of people that had tattoos: ritual magicians, slaves, and soldiers, and that's about it.
Yeah,
almost nobody else had tattoos, and this is traditionally the way that the Christian Church has looked at the issue of tattoos: is that it's not inherently unethical. We're not bound by Levitical ceremonial law, but it's been discouraged and it's been stigmatized because you either were under bonded or free service to a military organization where there's an exception for that, or you're a slave and it's a mark of your service, or you're a bandit or a wizard or something.
Yeah, like you're a member of MS-13 or something, and now they're mimicking the criminal thing. And this kind of goes out of the prison culture. Same reason why NBA adopted baggy shorts in the 90s. Was growing out of the prison culture. It's sort of a coarsening and sort of society. And now, like, I've gone to a Little League game and I'm looking at, I feel like I'm in a prison yard.
Yeah.
Like, his parents. And there's an aesthetic to this. You know, it's not, I don't want to be overly prescriptive or, I don't disregard someone because I know it's becoming more popular, so wider diverse people are going to have them, which says a lot, I think. But it just, another thing I just noticed, it's ugly, and it's just sort of the normalization of what was sort of a marginalized or subgroup of society,
right? Oh, and it also goes into sort of a body modification, right?
Yeah,
and the further depersonalization of man,
yeah,
right? That the body is just like a canvas that you can do whatever you want to. It's just the expression of your personality, this kind of Gnostic bifurcation of soul and body. That's kind of back to the Christian ethic thing. You see, is unfortunately, especially among the right, this kind of pagan spirit, right? I mean, the hallmarks of a pagan ethic are kind of a schizophrenia when it comes to the enforcement of virtue and of the person, because pagan in pagan Rome, I mean, abortion was rife. I mean, the midwives were also all abortionists. Mm-hmm. It was the same function. That was who did the abortions.
Like today's obstetricians. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
So.
And so that comes down to is that, the euthanization of the retarded and so forth. And so it's like that's the grand irony is that, you run into sort of pagan nationalist types, who claim to, act in a spirit of ethnic and racial solidarity, yet openly speak about, the destruction and euthanization and liquidation of mass parts of their own demographic, of their own population, oftentimes their own socioeconomic group, right? And so it's the further depersonalization of your own people who have been depersonalized by your enemies to begin with. You become the spiritual Jew.
Yeah, yeah. And again, you become a god unto yourself, right?
Right. Yeah, right, exactly.
And yeah, so and that's when you get this sort of this worshiping of race, the mystical racism that you got in the 19th century.
Sort of white Talmudism.
Yeah, and that's we don't want to go there, and that's nothing. And that's also where you also when you're observing societal decay, it's very easy to become a misanthrope, right? And and you have to be very careful about it because you have to realize. That the idea is to you want to make a world where it's good for for everybody, It's just and fair, and that's what I see a lot of, with that, with the sort of this revival of paganism is it's not that. It's actually it's very easy to become very misanthropic, and that's part of the dialectic I think that they want to promote, because ultimately that's not a winning political solution anyway. Like I like the idea of some sort of sense of decentralization and federalization, you know, confederated system where people have their own boundaries, their own sovereignties, and they can, you know, they're allowed to live the way they want to live and be unbothered by a central power. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, agreed. You know? Agreed. Yeah, I mean, and that is certainly the Western Germanic political tradition.
Yeah.
So it was perfectly organic, perfectly in line with our own indigenous sort of Anglo-Germano-Celtic political history. So yeah, I mean,
The United States for a long time seemed to have that sort of arrangement. I think it was never intended to persist too long. But you know the ethnic enclaves in the North and the United States and these things, and the country itself was fairly decentralized up until the 20th century. So it didn't really become problematic until the United States became this sort of this empire radiating, you know, instability around the world and calling it freedom.
Right. Well, exactly. Yeah, it's the sort of golem. Chaotic golem of the United States. That's very correct. But I mean, it, you know, it kind of comes back to, I think, the destruction of like Whig historiography, right? And I mean, because in the English language, you know, kind of coming back to the issue of nominalism. I mean, when you speak a specific language, you inherit an entire like semiotic system that you didn't invent, right? I mean, and a lot of that comes down, like, is that, you know, there's only a certain number of histories that are written in the English language, and most of these are written by, like, Freemasons.
Yeah, yeah. Right? The reason why we call the Dark Ages the Dark Ages, right?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Or Byzantium.
Yeah.
Right. And so forth. And so, you know, like, the only way that you can kind of get woke, so to speak, as the kids would say, and free yourself from the moral control of the Whiggish history is, you know, you have to kind of come to a realization that the British Empire was basically like an evil empire, you know. Yeah. And you know, I've got British blood. I mean, I'm very proud of my British heritage. I mean, my ethnic, you know, English identity and political and cultural heritage is very important to me. But the reality of the situation is that post Cromwell, the Anglo Empire was decidedly and distinctly evil and pernicious and corrupting, and that its mindset has always been. This is the irony: is you can go and read mainstream histories where they talk about this quite openly. You know, mercantilist and oligarchical.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the United States. You know, I mean, the United States colonies were set up for purposes of economic exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
By oligarchs, and it was The revolution was conducted by decadent oligarchs who didn't want to pay taxes.
Yes. The cult octopus.
Yes.
And there's a reason why the American flag was a replica of the British East India flag.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
It goes back to Canada. You know, the fact that most of Canada literally was the Hudson's Bay Corporation, literally, like, you know, the British North Canada Company, so to speak.
So.
And that's it. Is that you? I mean, you know, I ruffled a lot of feathers when I did my episode on American nationalism and kind of deconstructed that. But both of these countries, you know, Canada and the United States, are, you know, in their inception as civic institutions, not real. They're economic unions first and foremost. That is explicitly what the intention of the founders of these countries were doing in the creation of these colonies. I mean, in the United States, I mean, it was openly an economic union because it was a confederation of 13 different states, sovereign entities.
Mm-hmm.
That was the idea, right? I mean, and that's, you know, that's the original division of powers in the Constitution. That's very plain, right? That's why states don't have, you know, broad economic regulations or the ability to impose foreign tariffs, is because this is what it was about.
Yeah, it was a more or less a mutual defense pact and a common market,
right,
between the states. And again, to the extent that the Americans rebelled and freed themselves from British rule, the 19th century and the 20th century kind of reversed that, because
Right. And, you know, yes.
There's a reason why, was it God Save the Queen and God Bless America have the same tune? Right. And of course, the history of the 20th century was American muscle backing up the British in both two world wars. And, you know, and that gets into British Masonic Rothschild, you know, was Britannia rule the waves, but the 19th century Rothschilds controlled the British state. So now We're getting to the tip of the the pyramid here. I'm not sure where exactly it is, but it's, you know, this sort of Masonic Anglo-Zio-American empire. Oligarchic, you know, banker rule, maybe ultimately emerging out of Venice or Babylon or something.
I like to use the term synagogue of Satan.
Yeah.
The spirit of the Antichrist, basically. Yeah.
And I guess you could ultimately, it is the Antichrist, satanic. That's the sort of the entire Masonic project.
Right.
You know, which ultimately is the United States. You know, it's, sorry, I'm an American, but, you know, I just happen to be born here. But you do the research and you kind of find out, you know, these problems, the mythology that we're given, these things, it becomes a little uncomfortable, but it's the truth. I mean,
I think I made a funny comparison. I compared, like, American nationalism to national Bolshevism, NASBOL, where you believe the propaganda that your own regime produces, and then you just run with it.
Yeah,
like, unthinkingly.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, how do you believe, I mean, look at something as obvious as, like, the Spanish-American War, or the First World War, America's entry, at least, and, you know, lies that were told. How do you take any of this stuff seriously anymore? You know, take it seriously.
Well, I mean, Tim, frankly, I mean, Ken Burns told me different.
Ken Burns. I remember I was, Ken Burns. Yeah. Good filmmaker, but really it's like a, you know, I was letting my kids watch that, the Civil War thing, because it's very well done, entertaining. At least chronologically they can get an education. But I was in there, you know, that's not exactly right. You know, I was in there correcting
them. Right. Yeah, exactly.
You know,
his Vietnam series is interesting from a meta political perspective, because if you watch that Vietnam series and you basically think to yourself, so this is a piece of propaganda about basically a war that was all a piece of propaganda.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, you know, what is the message of that, of the Vietnam series? That the Vietnam War and the Cultural Revolution in America were synergetic, and they were done for the purposes of one another and fed into one another.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's the real takeaway from that documentary? Well, it's a documentary on the Cultural Revolution in the United States that was coupled with its foreign imperial adventures.
Yeah. And yeah, you said they're symbiotic. Neither of which were capable without that. And they relied on each other. And I would suggest that it was sort of roughly kind of planned out, because war itself is such a vast psychological warfare, social engineering enterprise. I mean, historians will talk about it, how wars fundamentally change things, right, in America, like the Second World War. And, you know, talk about how, you know, America was a different nation, emerged from the country, a different country. And Vietnam, how it changed things, the youth movement and these things. And the counter, or the anti-war movement itself was a controlled dialectic that fed off the war itself, and then it fed the culture and created the 70s and the disco scene and the depop, you know, the sexual liberation of the 70s. You know, yeah, started in the 60s, but really kicked off in the 70s and 80s, and that's when you get the divorce revolution and family breakup. And if you look at such documents like The Changing Images of Man and these things, the think tanks are kind of producing white papers and studies about how to change society. And then, goes back further back to what Norman Dodd and the Rees Committee exposed about the foundations in the early part of the 20th century, how they determined that to fundamentally change America, to collectivize it, to merge it, would be to subject it to a series of traumas, particularly war. And war is the best method by doing this. And lo and behold, we have the 20th century. I guess, was it an accident? I don't, you know. So,
Tim, I mean, it's all coincidences, Tim. I mean, really, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. It's coincidence. I mean, really. I talked about this before. I mean, but I think it's a point that's really worth emphasizing. I mean, like, about Whig history. And, like, one of the great lies of Whig history is the introduction of the idea of, like, the abstract corporate force.
Mm-hmm.
this idea that like there are just these forces of nature and things things just happen. They happen because the course of history dictated that it would happen. It's just how things are meant to be.
Yeah, the sexual revolution just happened. It wasn't because they're
that was just the organic flowering of the repressed desires of a people. It perhaps misguided, but it was a true attempt to express, you know, their inner repressed sexual cultural freedom, the liberation, the springtime of nations that is inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of Whiggish history. This kind of drivel.
Alfred Kinsey just showed up on the cover of Time magazine.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, of course, Tim.
And
I mean,
Marilyn Monroe became a movie star at just the right time that Playboy magazine comes out with her on the cover.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's just because she was sexy, Tim. What, are you gay? Come on. It's
like, that's another thing is that the type of female sexuality that's promoted, you know, the feminine of the blonde bombshell. I mean, it's absurd, isn't
God
it?
God save me from American kitsch.
Isn't it absurd? I mean, think about it. I mean, really think Marilyn went through her daily life doing that? I mean, acting? Maybe, you know, in real life where she was she herself spent half her time on her knees. That's the reality. I'm sorry, right? Yeah. But I'm saying the whole idea of this, the sex symbol is just, from the standpoint of, no, I mean, you can't live your life that way anyway.
Right. No, I mean, it's true. Right. And, you know, the introduction of like the American vulgarian seductress, you know, the bikini babe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, the Budweiser bikini babe. Right. And it's just so much.
Well, that was like Life magazine. It was like Sports Illustrated with the bikini edition, right? Then you had Fortune magazine, which is a Time Life Empire. That was American materialism. And then you had Life magazine telling us what life was like. And of course, then he's connected to the CIA. Henry Luce, that's all CIA. Skull and Bones.
Yeah, all CIA. Right.
You know.
Exactly.
I don't know.
Yeah, Playboy the same, right? And all that. No, I mean, it's it was funny. My granny was telling me about how my grandfather, who was a naval intelligence agent and a Royal Arch degree York Freemason, you know, had a subscription to Playboy.
And that was like telling, you know, it was cool, it was like sophisticated.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and then at the same time they're producing Ms. Magazine because the reaction, right?
Right.
The feminist reaction to this stuff and to the Playboy culture is feminism. And that's the same thing phenomenon I see kind of like with MGTOW and sort of these harpies, these the feminist slut culture. No one can get along now. I mean, that type of culture, you know.
Right.
This stuff is, you know, as Cornette, I was reading the introduction to Sean Stone's book New World Order, and the introduction is written by Richard Grove at Tragedy at Hope, and he's talking about he's summarizing this sort of sequence of events, and you're reading this paragraph like, how do you, you know, once you're aware of this, how do you not see it as a coordinated? He says, you know, how at the same time they're passing the federal income tax and creating the Federal Reserve, the central bank, they're mobilizing the country for war, and the oligarchs got together and bought out the top newspapers. And this is Oscar Calloway said this on the floor of the Senate. Well, the Senate, he was a Midwestern senator at the time. There's some, at that time, still independents in the Senate, and he said there was a conspiracy, if you will, of the financials just to buy up the top 12 newspapers in the country to control the news cycle, to facilitate. This is in 1915, to facilitate America's eventual entry into World War I, which had its own effect in Europe and changing the balance of power and weakening Germany, and this is sort of the Anglo powers weakening the continental powers and these things as part of the Mackinder Doctrine. But at the same time, you know, of course, out of World War I, you had the development of the Royal Institute of International Affairs, which develops out of Cecil Rhodes' Last Will and Testament, this plan for the English-speaking peoples to dominate the planet. So you have the Royal Institute of International Affairs being developed, along with the Council of Foreign Relations. And these bodies are financed by the biggest oligarchs in the world, you know, the billionaires at the time. And they're coordinating policy. They're developing policy for governmental bodies that are not yet even in existence. You know, even after it's like the Inquiry, which became sort of this the formation of the American Intelligence Community became OSS, became CIA. This, all this has been coordinated. The State Department was pretty much, after World War II, was populated by the Council for Foreign Relations.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, Tim. Life is just such a strange string of coincidences. What can you say?
And of course, and oligarchs and billionaires don't plan, you see.
No, of course not, because they're agents of the impersonal force of history, don't
and,
you know?
And the free market.
Right, in the free market, the invisible hand of the free
market. Free market.
Yeah, no, so this is back to the original point that I was making, that, yeah, I mean, this notion of the abstract, you know, non-personal force of nature reality is insane and also a lie. So that's the thing, is we, you know, back to kind of the essential insights of Christian theology. Well, Christian theology supposes that the Godhead is three persons, that the essential mm-hmm. nature of the cosmos is not only personal, but communal. It is interaction between persons. And so if we take this with sort of any seriousness and we apply this to our historiography, then we must conclude that all of history is just is the offspring of personalities and the interaction of personalities with one another. And the various things that occur in the world are all the fruits of the actions of particular personalities. And if you actually take that view of history, then that means that everything that happens, every policy that has ever been implemented, is the product of a personality and an organized personality. Right. Wow, that sounds a lot like conspiracy. I don't know.
Yes, yes. And here's the thing is liberty, liberalism, mm-hmm. constitutional liberalism, as we supposedly live under today, is because you'll advocate something like an organic political system, something like a monarchy or something. The reality is the liberal political order, they don't deliver the goods, okay? If you look at from a libertarian standpoint, the monarchies of the past were far superior.
Yes, this is if you ever get into it, to the listeners, if you are ever in a debate with somebody about the subject of democracy, the very, very simple way is you just ask them, okay, so do you actually believe democracy is better at producing competent leaders than any other system?
Watch the Brett Kavanaugh hearings.
Yeah, and honestly, like 90% of the time, unless they're like a tenured professor who's getting paid $200,000 a year to be like a professional liberal Democrat, or they're like a public school teacher who's paid much less to do the same thing, they'll be like, huh, you know, I guess I guess you're right. Do this Donald Trump guy? I don't know, right?
Yeah. As if a Barney Frank or Nancy Pelosi is any better or something. Yeah,
indeed. Right.
it's a good question.
Right. Yeah.
In terms of like government expenditure and these things, if you look at like, I think at the height of the Romanov dynasty, I think it was like 9% of GDP was spent by the government. And now it's what, under liberal democracy, it's like 45% in the United States, it's like 45%.
Yeah, there are other shocking statistics the early 20th century in Russia. There was more bureaucrats on the Île-de-France than there were in all of Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So how autocratic could that system be if you really think about it? Right.
Right. Indeed.
Yeah. Organic.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. It comes back to the control of language. What does autocracy mean? Autokrator is self-ruler. Right, it's the man who is ascetic.
Yeah,
right, a sovereign.
And look at the Constitution. It's just a scrap of paper, a damn scrap of paper, as one president once said. And the government doesn't follow it. And if they pretend to follow it, they have a court that is there to engage in all manner of sophistry and word salad to justify one abuse after another. Until pretty soon, it means nothing anymore. Right.
Another fantastic point. You know, if you're ever speaking to people about America and founding fathers and so forth, just bring up to them that Thomas Jefferson, the most liberal of the founding fathers, advocated for homosexuals to be hung, drawn, and quartered. Right? And you just seriously ask them. You say, okay, this is the same cause. This is the same government that just that legalized homosexual marriage under the Constitution.
Yes. The court can legalize things. And that's another thing, is the assumption the court can now read things into the Constitution or never there and legalize things. Five justices can do this. Not all nine, five justices can do this. You know,
three of whom are Jewish.
Yes. Right. Well, that has nothing to do with it. That's ridiculous.
I'm an anti-Semite. You know, I'm a Nazi, Tim. I mean, really. So
Ruth Bader Ginsburg is just a neutral legal scholar who reads the Constitution.
Yeah, well, I am very personally intimidated by the fact that she is a capable woman lawyer and judge, and she's got her life in order. She's powerful. She's competent. She's brave. She's beautiful. She's Jewish, and I can't handle that because I'm an fascist. I'm a white man. I've got fragile masculinity, and it's very difficult for me.
Yes, and same thing with Kagan too, because not because she's not to be trusted when it comes to something like free speech, nor does she's a mediocre at best with no paper trail. But she was supported, you know, put on the court, you know. Now, you know, so whatever. You're afraid of strong women. That's what it is,
right? You know, and I think just you know, I'm coming into a little bit the end here, around 2 hours. But before we leave, I want to make one point about the Western Germanic political tradition and the idea of liberty. In the ancient world, there actually was, in fact, a concept of liberty, libertas. Okay? And libertas, traditional liberty, is a very concrete political reality. And it refers to a state where there's a few important things, where a man A is free, okay? And in order to be free, he needs to have a couple of critical things. He needs to be A, arms bearing, so he cannot be placed under coercive force by another person. And he needs to be economically independent. He needs to have control over enough productive capital that if people try to economically intimidate him, he can take that loss and continue to eat and feed his family and, you know, put on shoes and ride a horse around and swing swords. And thirdly, he needs to have that particular military economic arrangement enshrined by explicit sacral oral custom or written custom within a community of his peers, you know, under the reign of a monarch who is under the law. That is the authentic Christian Western Germanic political tradition. And you know, there are we have written constant people can talk about the Magna Carta. The Magna Carta is a very late document. It's a very, very late document. We have written delineations of obligations between lieges and their subjects in Germanic culture going back to like the 4th and 5th century, like immediately when they were Christianized and had documents, and even before when they just had enough in contact with the Roman civilization, they were like drawing up what had existed for thousands of years already as an oral tradition. I am a social nationalist or national socialist, whatever term you want to use, right? Or I'm a radical monarch, whatever, you know. These labels to a certain degree begin to fall apart, right? But I'm very much in favor of traditional English liberty in a true kind of non-Enlightenment, non-Masonic sense. Mm-hmm. And it has an august 3,000-year-old tradition before Locke ever spewed any bile on the fair land of Bonnie England.
Yes. Yeah, okay, well, I think we covered it.
Yeah, well, it was fantastic. It was always a pleasure, Tim. You've got a really great podcast. Thank Hopefully, you. We can, you know, we can do another interview, maybe a little bit less than a year apart.
Okay, yeah. Okay, well, I'll let you go. I'm going to post this in a few days. When I do, I'll send you the link.
Fantastic. That'd be great.
And good luck with your endeavors.
Thank you very much, Tim, and with all of yours. May God bless you, and may his angels protect you and keep you from your enemies.
Thank you. God bless you back. And I'll let you go. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, long as I remember, the rain been falling down. Clouds of mystery forming, confusion on the ground. Good man through the ages, trying to find the sun, but Lord, I wonder.